Parthaya Pratibhojitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kathitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santutami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. It's one verse, chapter 13, verse 33. We'll probably finish this chapter today. And then I'll pass out the handout for chapter 14. Yata prakasha yatyekaha, yata prakasha yatyekaha, kritsnam lokam imam ravihi, kritsnam lokam imam ravihi, kshetram kshetri tata kritsnam, kshetram kshetri tata kritsnam, prakasha yati bharata, prakasha yati bharata, yata prakasha yati, Ekaha kritsnam lokam imam ravihi kshetram kshetri tata kritsnam prakashayati bharata.
I thought I had an extra book there. Where is it? What page are you on in this book?
180. What? 180. 180. Yatha, just as, ekaha ravihi, just as one son prakashyati, so yatha prakashyati ekaha kritsnam lokam imam ravihi. Ekaha ravihi. One, ekaha one, ravihi san namata. So ekaha ravihi. Yatha ekaha ravihi. Just as one sun prakashyati illumines, lights up. So just as the one sun lights up kritsnam lokam imam, this entire world. So on, just as one sun, or just as the one sun that we have, lights up this entire world. Krishna means entire, lokam world, imam this, okay? So, yatha prakashyati ekaha kritsnam lokam imam ravihi. Tata, similarly, kshetram kshetri. The kshetri is the atma, the knower, the subject. The kshetri is the purusha, you know, purusha prakriti, the purusha, the subject, the atma, the conscious being, the kshetri. So similarly, tata, the kshetri, kshetram kritsnam prakashyati. Prakashyati lights up kritsnam kshetram. This entire kshetra, this entire field of experience. So just as the sun lights up, just as the sun lights up this whole world, in the same way, the kshetri, the conscious being, lights up the entire kshetram. Remember, this chapter 13 has to do with differentiating between the purusha and the prakriti. The purusha is the atma, the self, the conscious being, the purusha. The prakriti is everything that is the material cause. Prakriti is the material cause for everything that exists within time and space. And so this chapter 13 really is a viveka, a discrimination between the kshetri. The kshetri is also the kshetrajna. Kshetri is the one who has the kshetra. So kshetri here means kshetrajna, the knower of the kshetra, the knower of the field. Kshetra means field. So field has a very broad application. Field can stands really for the entirety of your field of experience. So Krishna starts out in this chapter making clear that this whole chapter has to do with the viveka, differentiation between the kshetrajnam, kshetrajna, the knower, the kshetri, of the field of experience, and the kshetram, that which is the field of experience, so between the subject and the object. But he limits, initially, he limits his definition of kshetram, of the field of experience, just to this physical body, the body, mind, sense organs. And the kshetra is the one, the conscious being, the me, the self, that is aware of this kshetra, this body, mind, sense organs. And he does that, as Shankara says in the Bhasha, the reason he initially just limits it limits the prakriti or limits the kshetram to this body, mind, sense organs, is that no one has a problem with the rest of the world being the field of experience. Right? Nobody's got that problem. So the problem in terms of this subject-object differentiation really has to do between being able to differentiate me, the self, the conscious being, from the field of experience here, no problem, but this physical body also is a field of experience. It's also an object of my awareness, as is the rest of the kshetra. So are my sense organs. I know whether they're working or not. So are the thoughts in my mind. I'm aware of my thought flow. So are the emotions I have. So is the ahankara even, the I notion. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. These are all thought modifications, sensory perceptions, you know, physical sensations. In fact, the kshetram is really comprised of, in terms of my experience, whatever is subject to sensory, whatever is subject to objectification. And in terms of this physical world, this waking state, we say the kshetra is whatever is available to my sense perception. That's the waking state. That's the waking kshetra, the waking field of experience. What we call, you know, the dream state or the dream field of experience, or in Sanskrit we'll say the taijasa, that subtle realm, is really whatever it is that's available to the mind. It could be the dream state, it could be imagination, it could be meditative states of experience, it can be emotions, it can be memories. That's why we say when we're looking at the mind itself, the mind is a receptacle for all of your sensory perception. So if I'm looking at something, I'm looking at that painting with my eyes, the paint that my eyes are allowing my mind to have a thought modification of the painting. Or because I have ears, I can hear all of the sound. Because I have a sense of touch, I can feel. So through my sense organs, I can gain thought modifications in my mind, which then me, the conscious being, illumines. But your mind on a subtle level, just the mind itself, has functions that it can do that are independent of thought modifications. They're vrittis concerning, they can be vrittis concerning perceptions, such as any type of intellection or any type of inference. Maybe I'm performing around things that I've perceived, or any emotional states that I have, any imaginal states that I have, any type of memories. These are all independent of sense perception. They may be related to sense perception, but they're not brought to me by sense perception. In other words, sense perception allowed me to see that painting, but if I'm looking this way, it's the function of the mind to remember the painting. See what I mean? The mind has that capacity. The mind has the capacity to, on its own, continually, time and again, moment to moment to moment, identify my own presence. Your mind is continually identifying your own presence, the conscious being that you are, and labeling it as I or me. Right? And then taking that presence also and identifying it with something that you're experiencing. So, and this is constant, really, in a sense, through all of my experience. Like if I say, I am, I'm now at that point, my mind is identifying and labeling my beingness, my sense of being, my sense of self, my meanness. Or I am a conscious being. When I say that, I'm just in saying those few words, I'm labeling, the mind itself is acknowledging, is and labeling my own presence. And then if ajnanam, if ignorance is there, that same mind is able to say, I, this conscious being, am this physical body. I, this conscious being, am some quality in the mind. That's what we call the ahankara. That's a function of the mind. That's not the sense perception. It's a function of the mind. You see what I mean? Memory is a function of the mind. Imagination, a function of the mind. Dream, a function of the mind. Meditative states, a function of the mind. Not dependent on sense perception. That's why we have this taijasa, what we call the dream state, or that subtle realm, where the mind is operating in its own capacity, you know, maybe using data from sense perception, but it's operating on its own. So we say that there's four fields of experience, in a sense, or four categories of experience for the mind. One is the ahankara, this I notion, I'm doing this, I'm feeling that, I am this, I am that, I am the body, I am my mind, I am happy, I am sad, I am young, I am old, I am male, I am female, etc. All of these identifications, that's a category of the mind which I illumine, which I am aware of. I know what my mind is thinking, what it is doing, what it is feeling. Right? So also memory, that's another one. Also knowledge that I gain. Also the emotional states, fluctuating mind. These are all capacities that belong to the mind. These capacities are illumined. They're all the kshetra. They're all the field of experience. So this we need to know. We don't need to know this is the field of experience. We do need to know that this body is a field of experience, something I'm illumined, that I'm aware of. That the sense organs are a field of experience, I illumine, I'm aware of. Your thoughts, your moods, your emotions, even the I thought, field of experience. These experiences exist in time and space, and they come and go. This is a viveka that is not built in. This viveka isn't built in. Built in means you're not. This discrimination is not something that you're born with. You're born the jiva, transmigrating jiva, transmigrating individual, is in this transmigrating condition because of self-ignorance. And until that self-ignorance is removed, this anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition between me and this body, mind, sense organs, is a given. In fact, it's such a given for all human beings, all animals also, that it need not be thought about. The who am I question is not a common question. It's more like who am I within empirical reality. Who am I? What the heck am I doing? What am I doing with my life? That kind of, you know, what am I doing in school? What do I want to be when I grow up? Those are the who am I questions. It's not the who am I question of who am I really? Who is the one that is present to all of these passing roles, all of these passing states of experience? Who is this person here? Does this person, the one who I really am, am I one with this body? Am I one with a subtle body? Is there a subtle body? Am I one with all of my thoughts and moods and emotions? Do I die? That who am I question is not a given. It need never show up. Because the ahankara, the I notion, is very busy identifying your being with your experiences. I am this, I am that, I am this, I am that. I am feeling this, I am feeling that. I'm in this relationship, I have these qualities, I'm doing these actions. And continually, the ahankara is continually identifying the satchit, the constancy of my own presence with all of these passing experiences. And so that's why this whole chapter, and really, as you'll see, the whole chapter has to do with this this breaking down the kshetra, this viveka between the kshetra and the kshetra jnana. So here, if you remember, in the last verse, we used the example of space in order to help you differentiate your presence from your experiences. But in this verse, he's using a second example. Let's just look at 32 for a minute. I'll just tell you what it says. In this verse, he says, as a drishtanta, as an illustration, you know, just as space, which is all-pervasive, na upalupite, it's not touched by anything, because it's more subtle than everything. Space, air, fire, water, earth, space is all-pervasive. Fire doesn't burn, sweep space. Water doesn't wet it. You know, dirt doesn't stain it. The other five elements don't touch space. Space is all-pervasive. They exist within space, but they don't touch space. So he says, like that, abiding in this body, your being, the self that you are, abiding here in this body, itself, from the standpoint of the body, right? From the standpoint of the body, this self, na upalupite, it's not abiding in this body. It's not touched at all, and in fact, like space, it's all pervasive. It's a very interesting thing to understand, to think of, like space. It's useful, actually. This particular drishtanta is very useful. Because if I move, Swami chooses this one, we'll take a cup like this. If I move this cup like this, from A to B and back, right? It's moving through space. There's no such thing really as cup space, right? There's no cup space. And space is not moving. It's not touched. It's not contained. So the Atma is like that. Yourself is like that. Yourself isn't moving. It's not contained. In fact, when you do this analysis of differentiating your being from all of the things that you are perceiving, the subject-object experience that you have, the Atma, the self, yourself, enjoys a completely different order of reality than all of the things you experience. The closest we can get to that different order of reality is the difference between space and all of the other elements. Because of all the five elements, space is the most subtle, right? And so because it's the most subtle, it can't be contained. Now, in reference to your being, you are more subtle than even space. And there's even a different differentiation. Space, at least, can be differentiated from all the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth. It's one of the elements. We'd say that this space is not earth, it's not fire, it's not water. It's one of the five elements. But because it's subtle, the most subtle, it pervades the other five without itself ever being touched. That's the similarity. But now between you, the conscious being, and space, air, fire, water, earth, there's another distinction. And that is your presence, the conscious being, the consciousness that you are, the me, this conscious being that you are, unlike space, cannot be objectified into a subject-object relationship. You can't take conscious being and look at conscious being as though there's a consciousness here that can look at a consciousness over here. That kind of division doesn't exist. The only reason that you are self-aware has nothing to do with objectifying yourself, like you can objectify space and you can objectify the universe and the body and the mind and the sense organs and your thoughts and every experience that you have, you can objectify. And that's how they're known. For yourself, you can't do that. Consciousness isn't objectified, nor need it be. Consciousness is self-evident because it is consciousness. Because it is consciousness. The consciousness experience is consciousness. There's no objectification. But if there's no objectification, there's no subject-object relationship possible for consciousness. Consciousness can't be aware. And on the other hand, aware of itself, it can't be aware of itself as an object. It's aware of itself because it is consciousness. Do you see the difference? We can't bring in, like for consciousness, for example, you can't bring in another consciousness to illumine it. What's the division between this consciousness and this consciousness? Then we have to have consciousness as like a mind or something within space. So there's no way to illumine consciousness, no means of knowledge necessary to illumine consciousness, your being. And that being so, consciousness can't exist as an object within duality. For consciousness, for you, let's get personal about it, for you, the subject, the me, to exist within duality, you have to be able to objectify. You need a subject-object. You have to be able to objectify yourself. Oh, there I am. Without the ability to be objectified, consciousness is not a player within duality. And at the same time, consciousness, conscious being, being is consciousness is being, the conscious being, the me, the self that you are, is pervasive to every experience that you have, like space. Space is the most subtle of the elements. It pervades the entire creation. Space, it pervades all your experience, whether it's subtle or gross. And you pervade space. You just think about it in terms of your being. You illumine even space. And there is no experience that exists, subtle or gross, or in any manner of experience, that is away from conscious being. Even we use the example here, like in this room, I would say the painting's 10 feet from my body. Everybody's, yes, okay, 10, maybe it's 12 feet. 10 or 12 feet from my body. Yes, yes, true, true, true. How many feet is it from consciousness? How many feet is it from knownness? How many feet is this? From me, 3 feet. This body, 3 feet. How many feet from consciousness? From numbness? No feet. So in your experience, usually we're only relating to the relationship between me, the body, mind, sense organs, and the objects I'm relating with. We're not relating really from my being, from myself. If you're relating from yourself, then like space, there is nothing separate from you, nothing away from you, and nothing touching you. Because you're not objectifiable. Nothing touches space because it's the most subtle. Everything's moving around in space, nothing happens to space. Nothing touches me because I'm more subtle than space, but also I'm a different order of reality in that space can be objectified. I can't even be objectified to be an object within this dual kshetram that is being experienced. So this is the first example that Krishna uses to now trying to wrap everything up in this chapter to talk about the difference. The kshetra me, the kshetrajna, the knower of the kshetra me, is in fact subtle like space, all-pervasive like space. And from the standpoint of this body, as though it's existing in this body, because nothing is away from me. You know, like I can say, yeah, space is existing in this cup. It's existing in this cup. Absolutely. And it's existing in the walls of the cup too. But you know what? It's existing in the cup and it's free of the cup. It's existing in the cup but it's existing outside of the cup also. And so like that for you, in reference to your experience right now, even here in this room, from the standpoint of the body, yeah, the Atma, the self, the me, is definitely pervasive to and existing, you know, in and as the very being of this body. But if you just relax for a minute and include this body in the room, which it is, that's not hard to do, right? This body is in the room. And the room is in your consciousness. The thought modification of this room through your sense perception includes this body. Your thought, your perception of this room through your sense perception includes this body, right? So let's let the body belong to the room. And notice, or let the body belong to the room, which it is, it's part and parcel of the room. And through my sense perception, I am having a thought modification of this room, which includes the body. And that thought modification is equally pervaded by conscious being. You cannot have an experience, subtle or physical, that is not completely held by and enjoying for its being the conscious being, which is your me experience. This most personal consciousness, because I am the subject, always. Always. Always means I can never be the object. If I could be the object, then who's that subject? If I can be the object, who's the subject of that object? So it's impossible for me to be objectified. And so how can this happen? It can happen because from the standpoint of this mistake, I mean this confusion, it can happen because from the standpoint of conscious being, there's no confusion, there's just me. There's no mind, there's no sense organs, nothing. There's just conscious being. It's from the standpoint of the body, pervaded by the mind. So we'd say really that the mind gets indwelling this body. It's the mind that, as long as it's up, it's enjoying consciousness. Everything your mind, every feeling it has, every thought it has, your perception it has, it is enjoying me, conscious being. Why shouldn't it say, I am the conscious being? Because it's always enjoying me. There's never a time when it's not. It says, I am the conscious being. What it doesn't realize, and this is where this kshetrajna, you know, and kshetra viveka, discrimination, has to take place. It doesn't realize that it is always changing, mitya. It is always changing, always coming into being, going out of being. Every thought, every experience, change, 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 change. In me, the changeless. That's the viveka. You, the kshetrajna, are not subject to any type of change. You're always abiding, just me, always exactly the same way. But because I am untouched, right, and non-objectifiable, there's nothing to contain me. I'm only contained from the standpoint of the body that says I'm contained. From the standpoint of the mind that says I'm, doesn't say I'm contained, the mind says I am that. The mind with the body says I am this body. Only because that viveka is not there. And so here, as he's working through this, he's using first, in this verse 32, this example of the kshetra, of the space, to make you recognize the difference between your being, the kshetrajna, and the kshetra. And in this verse, he's using the example of the sun to illumine, to highlight the consciousness aspect of your being. The akasha, it's more highlighting the being of your being. With the ravi, the sun, it's more highlighting the luminosity of your being. Because of you, because of conscious being, everything, the kshetra, is known. Now the thing is, when we start looking at what he means, now he doesn't say the kshetram just as the physical body. he says Kritsnam Kshetram. Kritsnam means the entire Kshetra, the entire world of experience, the entire field of experience, which includes this body, this entire field of experience, really, it only needs one sun to illuminate. It doesn't need many suns. That's his drishtanta. Just as only one sun, one sun is needed to illumine all of this. Everything that falls within its purview, in the same way, there is only one me, only one Atma, only one conscious being that is necessary to illumine all of these objects. Objects means everything that is subject to objectification. All of these things that include the your body, your mind, your sense organs, all minds, all sense organs, all thoughts of all beings, all thoughts of all beings, all emotions of all beings, all bodies of all beings, all the jivas, everything that exists within duality, all of these are illumined by one kshetrajna, not two. Just one, there is one me. Now what's confusing, what gets people with this, well, I want there to be a personal me. That's a universal me. But what about me, the personal me? You know, that's the one I really care about. All right, there's a big universal me, and that's very interesting, God, all of that. But what about, who am I? And this is who you are. This is exactly who you are. There is only one me, and that one me couldn't be more personal. It's not about a personal me or a universal me. There is only one me experience. Not as an object, but just as the self-evident me that makes me me. So sometimes we use the example, in the Shastra they use this example in some of the Prakarna Granthas. You know, if I have a bunch of reflecting surfaces, a bunch of maybe mirrors and puddles of water and any type of reflecting surface, the sun is being illumined, is being reflected in all of those surfaces. Some surfaces are more muddy than other surfaces. Some are shinier, some are cleaner. You know, some are shiny, shiny mirrors. Some are muddy waters. Everything you can imagine, all these reflecting surfaces. And you say each reflecting surface says, I'm the sun. 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 That's what we're doing. The mind is saying, I, this mind. So it's not just saying, you know, I am the conscious being, labeling me. It's saying, I, the mind, who am one with this physical body, this body, mind, sense organs, person, me, that I've named whatever. This person is a conscious being, and you are a conscious being, and you are a conscious being. My mind and body are responsible for my conscious being. And your mind and body are responsible for your conscious being. And that this conscious being is the one I'm attached to, not some universal consciousness. Say, no. This conscious being that the mind is taking ownership of, by the mind itself because of self-ignorance saying, this conscious being belongs to me. What we're saying, what the Upanishads are saying is, no, you have to see something here. That the conscious being that the mind is labeling as you is labeling you correctly in that that is you, that its self-experience is you. It's not somebody else. It is correctly labeling you, the you that you are. That's true. That is you. It's just that this you, the me, the self that you are, that the intimate me, whom you love, whom you don't want to die, whom you want to know is free of bondage and free of death, it is this one that is the very self of the mind, but is also free of the mind. It is the one like how the sun illumines everything, and everything shines after the sun. Right? In a dark night, if all the luminaries are gone, nothing is perceived. See, if you blow out all the luminaries, the moon is not shining, the stars are gone, overcast, there's no fire, there's no type of light, the luminaries are gone, the sun's on the other side of the planet, there's nothing perceived. But when the sun is there, everything is perceived. Right? Even the dark clouds are illumined. The sun is the luminary, which is reflected on many different surfaces. And the surfaces on which it's not reflected, those surfaces are lit up, illumined, like this. This is not a reflecting surface, but because of the sun, it is known. Whereas, from the standpoint, say if I had this, this is known, this is illumined by the sun, but if I have a mirror, if I hold a mirror, the mirror is illumined by the sun, but also reflects the sun. They're both two materials, right? One is illumined, one reflects. Look at our situation here. Conscious being gives its being and knownness to everything. But these reflecting surfaces that we call minds say, because they're reflecting surfaces, say, I am. They as though manifest me to the point of identification. They can say, I am me. I am me, and without me, the mind, then I'll die. Okay? If the mind dies, if the body dies, the mind is here because of the body, and when the body dies, and the mind dies, then I die. That's this anyonya adhyasa. But what needs to be understood, this viveka, that you, in fact, exist changelessly amidst all of the experiences that you have ever had or ever will have. Your being exists changelessly as all of these experiences come into being and go out of being, come into being, go out of being. And that being so, there is no death for you. You are not within the death field. The death field is the field where time and space, where change in time and space, where change exists. That's the death field. The Atma is the self of that field, but not objectifiable. It's the being of that field, but not subject to the interactions and change of that world. That objectifiable world that we call the kshetra. So here, his second example, just as the sun can illumine many different things, like that your being illumines, the conscious being that you are, illumines many different things. So just as the sun illumines the whole field of experience, the whole universe, everything that exists within time and space, when any of that comes within the purview of the sun, it is illumined. Only one is necessary. Like that, only one me, only one conscious being is necessary and possible even as the ultimate luminary for all experiences of knownness. And that is me, the very me that you say is me right now. The only surprise, the me that you say is me right now is the me that is the me of all beings. The surprise is not going to be in you being you. The surprise is that you thought that you, what made you intimately you, had something to do with this body, so that when this body dies, you will die. Or when this sukshma sharira, the subtle body, transmigrates, somehow you will transmigrate. The subtle body will transmigrate. This physical body will die. But amidst all of that going on, like space as the pot travels through it, nothing happens to you. There's no traveling for you at all. There's no waking up or going to sleep for you. The conscious being that you are is the conscious being that you are and that all beings are and that Ishwara is. That's the whole Viveka. So he uses this example. So we have the example of the Akasha, the space, and the example of the Ravi of the sun to bring in kind of the Sat-Chit, the consciousness, is to understand that in the end, the Kshetra includes not only your mind and your sense organs, your emotions, all of your experiences, it includes everything that's perceived also. That's the Kshetra, everything, every experience that you have. This body is one of those experiences, and it's included in the whole field. Right? So the kshetra jnana itself is free of all of that because non-objectifiable. So with that, now having given these two drishtantas, he gives this last verse that really sums up the whole chapter. You know, I've been including a lot of this into what I've been talking about. We're going to do this verse now. Kshetra kshetra jnayorevam Kshetra kshetra jnayorevam Antaram jnana chakshusha Antaram jnana chakshusha Bhuta prakriti mokshancha Bhuta prakriti mokshancha Ye vidur yanti te param Ye vidur yanti te param Kshetra kshetra jnayoho evam antaram jnana chakshusha bhuta prakriti moksham cha ye viduhu yanti te param. Kshetrajna, the kshetra, the field, and the kshetrajna. So this is kshetra, kshetra-jnyoho in the genitive dual. It's a dwandva compound for Sanskrit people. Kshetra, kshetra-jnyoho, evam, in this manner, antaram, the difference, the distinction between the kshetra-jnya, the knower of the field, the atma, the conscious being that you are, and the kshetram, the field of experience, that's what exists in duality, whether subtle or physical. Anything that can be objectified is the kshetram. The antaram, the difference between, in this manner, between the kshetra and the kshetrajnaha. Jnana chakshuhu, by this eye of knowledge, by the eye of wisdom, by the eye of knowledge, chakshusha, jnana chakshusha. Bhutam prakriti moksham cha. Ye viduhu. Let's take the ye viduhu. Those who know, ye those who, viduhu. Those who know the difference between the kshetra and the kshetrajnaha evam in this manner, through this eye of knowledge, and ye viduhu, those who know the moksha, the freedom of one's being. From the cause of the prakriti here is the cause, from the prakriti, from the cause of all bhutas, of all beings. One who knows the difference between the kshetra and the kshetra, and knows the freedom of your being, the moksha, the freedom from the prakriti, the cause of bhuta, of the bhutas, all things that have come into being. Things that have come into being are things that exist within duality. Anything that comes into being, anything that is born, anything that is produced, from the five elements to all of the elementals, anything that exists within time and space is a bhuta. It's come into being. So bhutas can mean all of the conscious beings, all of the animals. It can include all of the five elements. It can include all of the elementals. It comes from the root bhu. Bhu means to be, to become. Bhuta means that which has become. That which has come into being is a Buddha. That which has been created has come into being. So the one who is free from the Prakriti, that which is the cause of all of this coming into being. Shankara says that Prakriti is here the avyakta, it's the avyakta, it's the unmanifest. The unmanifest is what? The ajnanam. The ajnanam, the Prakriti is really, from the standpoint of the jiva, the ajnanam which has brought about this ignorance-based superimposition between your being and the things that come and go in your experience. The Prakriti, from its causal condition, causal standpoint, is responsible for all of that. To understand, just a little quick thing here. If you have a dream, or if you have, say if you have an imagination, I ask you to imagine a meadow. When you imagine the meadow with all of the beings in the meadow, all of the people in the meadow, etc., that imagination comes from your meadow knowledge, right? Comes from your meadow knowledge. You have, that meadow knowledge has now come into manifestation. So you're the meadow Ishwara. You're the Lord of the meadow. There's no ajnanam involved. Whereas it's knowledge that has allowed that meadow to manifest, to come into manifestation. If there was no meadow knowledge, and I asked you right now, have an imagination of a meadow. Yeah. Have it, go on. This happened to me when I was teaching in Sweden, not this year, last year. I like this meadow illustration, to use a meadow imagination. And every night I would have a satsang and people have question and answer, right? So now we're at the very last day. And somebody asked the question in the satsang near the last day, what is a meadow? Because they all speak Swedish, you know. They're from different parts. This is in Sweden we had this. What is a meadow? Oh, yikes. Yeah.
That was my illustration.
Yeah, I've used that so much. I've used that meadow so much. But it's a good example. You know, Swamiji uses the example, like if I were to say, bring the gagubuga. Bring me the gagubuga. And nobody can do anything. Because the word doesn't mean anything. There's no knowledge. There's no gagubuga knowledge. Right? And so if I ask you to imagine a meadow and you know what the word means, your meadow knowledge will come into manifestation. You are the Ishwara of the meadow. There's no ajnanam there. There's no ignorance there. You know? It's a manifestation of your knowledge. See what I mean? It's not about ignorance. It's a manifestation of your knowledge. There can be, we're not talking that you have limitless knowledge. We're only talking about your meadow knowledge. So now you've had a manifestation of your meadow knowledge. You're the Ishwara, the Lord of the meadow. It comes from you, is sustained by you, resolves into you. And the Prakriti is there for you, is what we call the Maya. That's your Maya that comes into manifestation. But from the standpoint of those within the manifestation of your knowledge, they are all bound by ajnanam. Like all of the, say you put a bunch of animals and a bunch of living beings and people in the meadow manifestation. From their standpoint, they don't have any knowledge because they are limited by the upadi, by the limitations of the conditioning adjuncts. They are not the whole meadow, right? They are little products within the meadow that enjoy limited knowledge. So they, from their standpoint, are bound by the Prakriti. They are bound by the Maya. For them, the Maya is acting as ajnanam. They don't know they're the meadow. They don't know that they're the conscious being from whom the meadow has come. All they are, because they have sukshma shariras, subtle bodies, they're all just enjoying conscious being, looking around through the sense organs as being a conscious being within the meadow. And then one out of a billion asks, what's going on? Why am I here? What's the truth of all of this? Who am I really? That's a weird person. Very few. weird in the sense that not common. Why am I here? Who am I? What is the truth of all of this? Is there a God? All of these kind of questions. When you have these questions, and they're not just passing questions, oh, I wonder if there's a God or not. Oh, well, who cares? not like that. For some people really want to know, really need to know, what is going on here? Is there no way out? Because there's so much involved in this type of mumukshutvam, in this type of viveka. So, from the standpoint of the jivas, individuals within the meadow, or these jivas within the prakriti, right? The prakriti itself is acting as ajnanam because of the limiting adjuncts of the mind and sense organs. That mind and sense organs has to accrue, collect knowledge, right? Until my mind lands on that painting for the first time, I have no idea of its existence. I'm like a walking flashlight. Wherever my mind falls upon, there something is lit up. But what's lighting me up? I'm always lit up. But in terms of the antakarana vritti, the thought modification that gives me knowledge, what is lighting me up? Nothing. I'm lighting it up. I'm lighting up the mind. But the mind's not lighting up me. See what I mean? So this mind that is lit up by me, that enjoys me, is itself clueless about who is the one, or that there is even one lighting it up that is differentiated from itself. And so when this viveka between the kshetra and the kshetrajnaha, this antaram, the one who knows this difference, and is thereby really freed from the prakriti, because the ignorance is being removed, your being is freed from the ajnanam, which is the prakriti, the ignorance which is the prakriti, which is the ignorance that all beings which are in the creation are bound by. Bhuta prakriti moksham. One gains that knowledge, which itself is the freedom from the kshetra, which is the prakriti, which is the cause, which is the cause for all of this becoming. One realizes one's being is totally free from that. And those who know this, te yanti param, those go to, in quotes, those go to the param. They go to the self. They don't go in terms of travel, because you already are the self. But they go to the self means the ahankara itself resolves now into the atma, instead of resolving, landing on the body or mind or sense organs where this mutual superimposition is there. That ahankara, that I notion that's really born of ajnanam, it goes to what is param. Param, like parama, is this desha call of us to aparicheda atma. This conscious being, the self, the atma, which is itself free from time and space and objectification, which is limitless. Param means the paramatma, which is limitless, which is the very being of the kshetra, but is at the same time totally free from the kshetra. In your dream or your imagination, you are the self of the imagination, and you are free of the imagination. Otherwise, every time you have an imagination, you're born into the imagination. How are you going to get out of that? You've converted into the imagination, transformed into the imagination. That's not true. Your being plus Maya is capable of imagination. Your being from your being, the conscious being that you are, plus the total Maya, that we call the Samashti Maya, total Maya, right, is responsible for the whole creation. Whether it's a little imagination or whether it's the whole creation, you're the self of it. Your being is not an object in the creation. Your being is the self of the creation. And so, with that, he ends this chapter. So, you have.
Is there any more yellow first? Won't touch it.
Yeah, but I have to read that. Let me see your little thing there, Wood. Om Tat Sat. Om Tat Sat. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Upanishatsu. Upanishatsu. Brahma Vidyayam. Brahma Vidyayam. Yoga Shastre. Yoga Shastre. Shri Krishna Arjuna Sambade. Shri Krishna Arjuna Sambade. Kshetra Kshetrajna Vibhaga Yoga Nama. Kshetra Kshetrajna Vibhaga Yoga Nama. Trayodasho Dhyayaha. Trayodasho Dhyayaha. Om Tat Sat. Om is Brahman. Okay. Ishwar. Om. This is the Mandukya Upanishad. Om. Om. Tat Sat, that is the truth. Tat, that, Sat, truth. Om, Tat Sat, Om. The reality, Ishwara. It has for its truth, Brahman. Tat, that, is Sat. That is reality. That is the truth. Thus, iti, in this Srimad Bhagavad Gita, which is Upanishadsu, which is viewed and held as an Upanishad, because the Brahma Vidya, so it says, in this Bhagavad Gita, which is revered as an Upanishad, even though it's not an Upanishad, it's held and given the same esteem as an Upanishad. Brahma Vidyayam, in this Brahma Vidya, this knowledge of Brahman, Yoga Shastra, in this knowledge, in this Bhagavad Gita, which is the Brahma Vidya, knowledge of Brahman, and which is a Yoga Shastra. Yoga Shastra means it also teaches Karma Yoga and Upasana, all meditation, all of the things that are necessary for Antakarana Shuddhi, for maturity of mind, right, for purity of mind, bringing the mind into a disposition where it can not only gain this knowledge but hold it also. So it's a Yoga Shastra. It's a Shastra that it gives Brahma Vidya, but it also gives everything that is needed to bring about Antakarana Shuddhi. So, Shri Krishna Arjuna Sambade, in the Sambada, Sambada is a dialogue, but it's a dialogue between Guru Sishya. It's not just a Vada, it's a Sambada. It's a special dialogue. It's the dialogue between teacher and student. So, in this Sambada, between Shri Krishna and Arjuna, Kshetra Kshetrajna Vibhaga Yoga Nama. This dialogue, so in this, goes by the name of, which is called the Vibhaga. The yoga here just means topic, which has for its name the topic, which is the Vibhaga, the differentiation between the Kshetra and the Kshetrajnaha, the field of experience and the subject, okay? Purusha Prakriti. Trayodashaha Dhyayaha, this 13th chapter. So thus, that iti, om, this is the truth. Thus, the 13th chapter, called the Kshetra Kshetrajna Vibhaga, this chapter is completed. That's the iti. Okay? Thus, the 13th chapter says, om, this is the truth. Thus, this 13th chapter, in this Bhagavad Gita, which is the Brahma Vidya, which is revered as an Upanishad, which is the Brahma Vidya, which is also the Yoga Shastra, which is in the form of a dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna. Thus, this 13th chapter is completed. Shute Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishute Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Hari Om.
There was a word that got to me. It wasn't the word meadow, but it's the word Prakriti. And when you
Prakriti.
Were, yeah, when and I had a glimmer of a partial sense of it when you were talking about the meadow example of how Prakriti works there.
Yeah.
But I'm less. I have less of an understanding of how it's used normally.
Do you know? Prakriti is a synonym in Vedanta for Maya. Right? So Prakriti is Maya. Means it's the material cause for the manifestation of the creation. You know, so it's the word that we use for material cause is called upadana karanam. Upadana karanam means cause. Upadana karanam. When we say that Brahman, just pure conscious being, is in truth the material cause for the whole creation, Brahman is. Because Advaita, there's only one conscious being. It is the truth of everything. Like the clay is the truth of the pot, or water is the truth of the ocean. Like there's many, many waves and all that, but there's only one water. That's Brahman. Right? But then what is the upadana, and we call that, in fact, Vivarta upadana karanam, because Brahman is non-dual. There's nothing else but Brahman. And so Brahman, because there's nothing else but Brahman, it can't go through any modification because it has no parts. And there is nothing outside or inside. So there is only Brahman. So it can't become anything. And yet there is nothing that doesn't have it for its being. So we say Brahman is the material cause of the creation. But then you have to say, but what's the material cause of all of the names and forms? What do you call that? Well, that's what we call Maya, or Prakriti. And that also is the Upadana Karanam, but it's the Parinama. Parinama Upadana Karanam. It's the material cause that is responsible for all of the Namarupa, all of the names and form. And that Parinama means that which modifies. That Parinama Upadana Karanam is mitya. Anything that exists within duality, anything that is subject to coming into being or going out of being, is mitya. Right? So Prakriti is mitya. Maya is mitya. That's its order of reality. Mitya means that it depends for its being on something else. You know, like the pot depends upon the clay. The pot is mitya, the clay is satyam, real. Relatively within the confines of that example. The snake is mitya, the rope is satyam. Without the satyam, there is no mitya. You can't have, mitya can't exist without what we call an adhishtana, something that is it depends on for its being. It won't be labeled as mitya. For it to be labeled as mitya, it has no being of its own. Right? And so Prakriti, which is the material that we call Maya, right? That is responsible for the manifestation of the meadow. Right? What allows for the manifestation of the universe? The manifestation of an imagination, the manifestation of a dream, the manifestation of anything that's subject to change. That is the Parinama Upadana Karanam that we call Maya or Prakriti.
Is there any distinction between Prakriti and Maya?
Not really. However, if you go into the darshana, the Sankhya Yoga Darshana, which is Sankhya, which is another school of thought in the six darshanas or six philosophical systems in India, really, that accept the Vedas as Pramana. The Sankhya makes a distinction between, it uses the term prakriti in a different way. When we use the term prakriti, we mean maya. When the Sankhya the Sankhya does not use the term maya. It only uses the term prakriti. And it uses prakriti in the way that we do, as the material cause for all names and forms, the material cause for all duality. That's exactly in the same way. Even the way that the creation unfolds, and that we call the Panchikarana, same, basically the same. But what is different is that for this, in Sankhya, when they use the word prakriti, they don't have it as maya. They have it as something which is real, that has a reality of its own, separate from the Purusha. We use the Purusha as Atma, Brahman, as a synonym, like Purusha Suktam. Purusha is a common word for us. They don't use the word Atma or Brahman in Sankhya. They only use the word Purusha. We use the word Purusha as a synonym to Brahman, to Atma. It means the person, the being, you know, the conscious being, Purusha. But they use Purusha and Prakriti only for the Purusha. For them, there's many, many Purushas, and there's the Prakriti, which is the material cause of the creation. So that can...
If you say, at one point you were saying, you know, it's the material cause of the creation, and then at one point you referred to it as the material, which is the cause of the creation. And that kind of threw me because...
Oh, yeah.
When we're talking about a subtle thing like an imaginary meadow,
yeah,
what material is there?
Yeah, because that's right. That's all a language problem. Because when we think of material, we think of physical material.
That's what I do, yeah. So
that's
a different way to think about it.
Yeah. If you look at prakriti as... What would be a good word? Like when you say... material cause. When you say material cause for the manifestation of the creation subtle and gross, then the material no longer becomes physical material. So if you say that which is the material cause for the projection of the dream image, there's something, so you can get rid of the word material, even though we do use it in this word upadana, upadana karanam. It means what is responsible, what is actually the substance? What is it that's responsible for projecting the dream vision, or projecting the meadow, the picture of the meadow? What is causal to that? So prakriti is the causal, and we use the word material, the upadana karanam, for that which projects as the world.
It's used in distinction to the efficient cause, right?
Yes. And the efficient cause is going to be what we call the nimitta karanam. The efficient cause is the conscious principle in all of that. So Ishvara is the nimitta karanam. Consciousness with the maya upadi becomes the nimitta karanam. If you remove the consciousness from it and you're just looking at the Namarupa, the name and form, then we say that's the upadana karanam. The nimitta karanam is the conscious principle, which brings in Ishvara. It brings in Ishvara because there is no nimitta karanam, efficient cause, from the standpoint of Brahman. You need maya to even think about a nimitta karanam, an efficient cause, because that involves duality. See what I mean? So Brahman's not... For Brahman, there's no cause and effect. Even the word upadana karanam, material cause, is totally irrelevant to Brahman. Because from Brahman's standpoint, all that's there is Brahman. Like from the clay standpoint, there's only clay here. Right? I'm not the material cause of anything. I'm all that is.
Right? It's only from that standpoint.
That's right. It's only from the standpoint of a maya, or from the standpoint of the creation, or from the standpoint of the mind, that this type of discussion comes in. Mm-hmm. But the discussion is important because the fact is that you are Brahman. The mind is Brahman. The body is Brahman. There is nothing that isn't Brahman. But that is what the mind has to discover, because from the mind's position, standpoint, because of ignorance, a natural, beginningless ignorance, all the mind knows is that I am the mind and I exist and I'm a conscious being and I'm existing in this body and this body is going to die. That's what I know for sure. I know for sure that this body is going to die. And I know that when this body dies, I don't know for sure what happens to me. All the religions say there's some heaven and hell and all of this, you know. Hinduism say there's traveling, from transmigration. But all I really know, in terms of my own experience, is that I am abiding in this body-mind complex and the body definitely dies. I know that, and what happens after that, I don't really know. I can have beliefs.
Yeah, that's where it's easy to see that I am the mind. That's
because it's true also.
That's true.
It's true.
Can we experience I am that is free of the mind?
Yes, that's the viveka. That's the viveka right there.
Oh, you experience it by viveka.
Yeah,
by
that's in the verse that we did, Jnana Chakshusha, by the eye of knowledge. Mm-hmm. You can't look at it mm-hmm. as an object. But the fact is that the mind and the experiences are coming and going. That's a fact. And you're not. That's also a fact. And you are self-evident. You don't need to be lit up by a pramana, by means of knowledge. You're self-shining. And the one who is self-shining as conscious being, me, is never changing. And everything else is. So the mind itself can recognize this fact. It can recognize the fact of all of its experience coming and going itself, everything about itself continually changing. And an adhishtana, the conscious being me, never changing. That is the viveka.
And that's the experience of I am free of the mind.
Yeah.
That understanding is.
Because I am, well, the understanding is pointing to the fact. The fact is that I am free from the mind and the understanding is just not an intellectual understanding, it's a recognition, a viveka, a discrimination between the fact of it, that I'm never changing, and everything that I've taken to be myself and everything external to myself is subject to time and space and change. And this becomes what we call a paroksha. A paroksha means it becomes self-evident, it becomes recognized. Because it's there to be recognized, not just, it's intellectually true also, but it's not just intellectual. It's the recognition of the fact of it.
And in the midst of the muddy water, the sun shines in the water, there's still viveka.
Yeah, but this is what has to be remembered about this. Remember, all these illustrations have little... They're not perfect because they're illustrations and they're not the truth. They're not the actual reality. And say in the sun, the drishtant illustration of you are the sun is illumining the muddy water, the clear water, the agitated water, or the muddy water, the agitated water, the clear water. Equally, three water buckets, equally the sun, equally warming them, equally illumining them. But in those water buckets, you have a very dim sun because of the mud. Right? You also have an agitated sun because of the movement of the water. And you have a reflection of the sun in the clear water that's pretty clear to true to the sun. So I'm comfortable, this if you take the water as the mind, I'm the most comfortable in the quiet mind. Because that reflection, that nature, the nature that that quiet water is enjoying is closest to me. And in the muddy water is more like a depressed mind where I'm barely visible there. Okay, but now, the thing is about this example, where does the me abide? It's not the reflection. These are just mental states that resonate with me or don't. But I'm the sun. That's me. That's the me experience, is the sun. That self-experience never changes. It doesn't care whether the mind is muddy or clear.
But the tendency is for the mind to take that for real, that it is me.
Yeah.
But it's a state.
It's a state. The mind is having a muddy state or a clear state, but there's my presence that is my real presence of the real sun that is present and the luminary in all three of those states, and that is never muddy. And it's never muddy, it's never clear, it's never agitated, it's never anything except itself. And it is fully present. It doesn't require the mind to be in any given condition. So when you have that viveka is there, you can have, you know, a muddy thought or a depressed thought, which is not optimal. We don't want to have a depressed thought. We'd much rather have a happy thought or a shantavritti or whatever. But my being is not covered by that. The sun isn't covered by what it illumines. And that is the viveka. Otherwise, this is the big, this is the number one, somebody asked me this question, I don't remember, what is the number one problem? Who asked me that? What is the number one problem in, oh, I remember, it was at the ashram, I was giving a satsang. And one student asked, what is the number one problem? These students are all finishing up the 3-year course, you know, they're all ready to go out. What's the number one problem? You know, conveying this knowledge. I said, this is the number one problem, is that we're so, because of the superimposition, we're so used to only thinking about states of mind, mm-hmm. and thinking about gaining self-knowledge as gaining a state of mind. Mm. And it is not a state of mind. It is a recognition of the self that illumines and is present to every state of mind, and that is never covered by any state of mind.
Yeah, you can do that, but then right away you start thinking about the state of mind again.
Well, maybe, but that's why we have to hold up this mirror time and again, and that's why knowledge doesn't take place in one sitting. Because, you know, they use the example of opening, of if you're in a swamp and you open up the reeds, then you see all that water. But as soon as you lift up your hands, the reeds cover over and the water's gone. Mm-hmm. We used to always joke, you know, we'd be listening to the class and the Swamiji would open up the reeds, everything would be completely clear until we got out the door. Your ragged dvesas, your likes and dislikes, your hurts, all of these things that cause the reeds to snap over, all of your wanting things to be in one way or another, needing this and needing that, these things all drop off and your mind becomes more free to see. It takes some time.
So when you say the initial recognition is there is a vritti that is the recognition, but then once the recognition occurs, there's no vritti needed to know that you're you.
Yeah, right. There's a recognition. That's right, but the thing is that it's a little bit different, actually it's very, very different than our normal way of gaining knowledge, because in the normal way of gaining knowledge, we're gaining knowledge of something that is not me. So it's something out here, in mm-hmm. a sense. And so there's two mechanisms involved that are kind of happening simultaneously. One is called, in any knowledge that we gain, this is what we're used to. First there's vritti vyapti. It means my mind, through sense perception or through some mental activity, takes on the form of the object. Like that painting, for instance, my mind, through my eyes, is pervading the vritti. That object pervades the vritti, the thought modification. It's called vritti vyapti. And having pervaded the thought modification, it is known, because conscious being is illuminated. That's called palavyapti. And so when we are gaining knowledge of anything in a subject-object relationship, these two things take place. First, the mind has to assume the form of the object, and when it does that, that object is then illumined, not really sequentially, it happens, right, because consciousness continually is illumining the vritti, but that must take place, okay? So this is how we gain knowledge. At here, in self-knowledge, it's different because the self is always here, you know? There's nowhere to go, right, to gain it, and there's no way to lose it. And so now what has to happen, because yourself is present, what has to happen is that through the teaching methodology, the mind is directed toward its own content. And it has a vritti vyapti of the conscious being, which is its very self. Right? Now, there's no pulavyapti. But the pulavyapti is already finished, because the pulavyapti and the vritti vyapti are the same. There's no two things. We're now we have this vritti vyapti, and now consciousness has to perform its function of illumining the vritti. Well, the consciousness is what the vritti needed to know. And so once that agnanam, that ignorance, is removed, the vritti is totally unnecessary from now on. Mm-hmm. Because the content of the self is the content, the self is the content not only of that knowledge vritti, but of all vrittis.
So, but you might need the vritti if you're not stable, right?
That's why you didn't need a dhyasana, because you're...
So then you bring the mind back
to what you know.
To have the vritti, so to speak, and then you can drop the vritti and just...
Well, really, once that vritti is there,
mm-hmm.
it's not so much that the vritti is needed again, but in Nididhyasana, you have to just bring your mind back to what you know. And you can have the vritti over and over again, but you don't need to.
Right, okay. Yeah,
because the self is already there. Right. It's already recognized. So that's just a little subtle thing, but in Nididhyasana, what we're doing, in the difference between Nididhyasana and maybe conventional ideas of meditation that you might have, is in Nididhyasana, we're giving our mind a chance to just sit with a self that we know. Because the mind is so habituated to identifying with the body, identifying with the likes and dislikes, and it has its own thought patterns, its own habitual responses. And so with Nididhyasana, what you're doing is you're breaking what we call the Dehatma Buddhi. The Dehatma Buddhi means that buddhi, that conviction, that the Atma is the Deha. Deha means body. That the self is the body, mind, sense organs. There's a conviction there. You know, and so the mind just goes off almost unconsciously, falling into this conviction, and then you bring the mind back to what you know, the self that you know. But you already know that self.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
So saying that the body is myself, that's a pulavritti?
No. Saying that the body is myself is just the agnanam. That's the natural conviction that we bring to this knowledge. That's the natural beginningless ignorance that we bring to this body, into this knowledge, that the Atma is this body, mind, sense organs, and maybe it isn't, but we don't know that for sure. And so, really, this knowledge is, there a lot of assimilation has to take place, because everything that your mind has experienced as true, you know, is all of a sudden recognized as not true. And you see it, but all the grids, and all of the inner paradigms and all of the grids inside of the mind are based on agnanam, on self-ignorance.
Yeah, so that one thought doesn't have much of a chance against that.
Yeah, that's right. They use that example. In fact, it's like, they use the example of, say, you know, so Swamiji tells it, say there's a beach party and the kids all build a huge bonfire of driftwood, you know, great big huge one. You know, it's a little windy out, and they have going to have to light this thing. And so they have to find one little corner where they can protect it, you know, and get that flame going and then, you know, protect it and, you know, give it some strength. And just a little, protect it from the wind and just keep it going until it starts to grow. And then as it grows, it becomes stronger and stronger and stronger until the wind and the environment just, or you know, fan it on till it burns the whole thing. But it takes a while before it catches on. That's likened to our vrittis. You gain this knowledge, so you come to the teaching and this knowledge takes place and this little bonfire has now just been lit. Right? And you see something, you know, it can resonate so deeply in you, but now you have to protect that for some time. But after some time, that knowledge doesn't need any protection. It just, of its own accord, burns away any ignorance that's there.
So tell me again, though, how is that different than not having to see it over and over again, because you've already recognized it?
Well, the difference is only that you're bringing your mind back to something which you already know.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's not that we don't have that vritti over and over in contemplation. You have that vritti over and over, but you're having a vritti of something that you know, as opposed to something that you don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Edward brought up a question earlier about Prakriti and Maya. Just I want to fill that out a little bit more. Why would you sometimes use the word Prakriti and sometimes Maya? Sorry. Is it just whatever seems the best word to use, or is there a distinction between them?
There's subtle distinctions, like maya, if I do that, even though they're referring to the same thing. Ya ma iti maya, that which is not, that is maya. Right? Means that just highlights the adhishtana, the satya mitya, you know, the whole relationship of the word maya, highlights the relationship of maya really to the adhishtana, because that which is not, that is maya. Right? It means it has no being of its own. Where Prakriti has more, you know, that which is well made, being like that. But you know, it's just, but we don't really deal with that type of a difference until we go into the etymology of the root word. Like in Sanskrit, they have many words for one thing. Like one easy example that I like to give is like the word vriksha. Vriksha means, it's a word for tree. It means that which can be chopped down. Another word for vriksha is taru. Taru means that which has roots. And there's 100 other words for tree. There's 100 words for cloud. There's many words for chaitanya, for consciousness. You know? And the beauty is that each one of these words, you can go into the etymology of the word and they just hold something about the nature, you know, of what they're describing in a beautiful way. That's why, you know, like when we have the 1001 names of Vishnu that we're learning, these are made of compounds, so technically they're one word often. They're just one word that are made of two or three words. But the words are containing in themselves, saying in 1,000 different ways the nature of Ishwara.
So the etymology is itself a kind of like a drishtanta?
Yeah, in a sense. Not drishtanta, but a definition. The etymology of the word will hold an aspect, highlight an aspect of the word. You know? Like the word deha, there's many words for body also. But the word deha means that which is burned, that which is to be burned, because all bodies, when they die, they're cremated. You know? The word purusha is the one who is lying in the city, the six-gated city of the physical body, the one who is lying there, abiding there.
So what are the etymological differences between Prakriti and mind?
Well, Prakriti has more of the sense of just the material, you know. Kriti means that which is made. Pra means that which is made well. So Prakriti. But we really have to ask Swamiji for more etymology of that, where Maya is putting more emphasis on the Maya of it, the Mithyatva of it. And Prakriti is putting more emphasis on the wonder of this amazing material. And just think of it. You can, with the Prakriti and Maya, you can imagine anything. Just like that. You can have a dream. You know, you can think, you can imagine, it's an incredible thing. And then if you take it up to the creation, it's responsible for the manifestation of this whole infinite creation. So it's this amazing substance we call Maya.
It's kind of a capacity, isn't it? That you,
well, it's a capacity, but if you want to say that, but I think it's better to what Swamiji is using now. I think works really well, and that is manifest knowledge, because you can understand it in terms of your own experience. Like if I ask you right now to think of your car, you probably weren't thinking of it, but it was there to be thought of, right? Mm-hmm. So it was unmanifest coming into manifest knowledge. So what if you look at the whole creation as manifest knowledge? Mm-hmm. Then when you look at that in reference to your own manifest knowledge, then what you understand really that this creation is an infinite being. The whole creation as manifest knowledge is known. That's what manifest knowledge means.
How is grace addressed in the teachings? Like really, like when you have complete knowledge, and then, but there is also grace needed for complete understanding, isn't it?
Well, we say Ishwara Anugraha, mm-hmm. the grace of Ishwara, to gain this knowledge or to even bring you to a teacher. But that Ishwara Anugraha, really, from another aspect, is your own punya, because otherwise you have to say that Ishwara gives you grace, but not you.
Yeah.
Like there's favoritism.
Yeah.
Why is Ishwara giving you grace and not me?
Yeah.
Well, because he likes me better. Doesn't have anything. It has to do only with punya. Yeah. And that's the grace of Ishwara.
So it's your punya, not Ishwara offering, giving you great offerings or something.
Well, not as a form of favoritism, but as a form of what the natural laws of the creation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that is Ishwara's anugraha. It's a grace. It's a grace.
So it's just a natural unfolding of what is already in your prapta karma or your punya. That's then.
Well, yeah, that would give the mumukshutvam, you know, that would bring you to a teacher, you know, with punya. It has to do with dharma. To have even a mind that has the inner space to be available to this type of knowledge, to be interested in it, that's a huge thing. That means that there's room inside, reflective, self-reflective room. You know, it requires a certain quietude of mind.
And also,
and that's considered punya.
Also, having the ability to find the topic interesting, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Most people would be, how long is this class going to last? But actually, that isn't true, because you know what they say? That even to get anywhere near this teaching is tremendous punya. That's what the tradition says. Mm-hmm. Even to get, because look at, just in terms of your own karma, the sphere of your experience is quite limited. The people you've met, the places you've been, even if you've done a lot, it's still pretty limited in terms of what's available, in terms of the knowledges that are available, the understandings that are available. I mean, we know so little compared to what is there to be known.
Yeah.
So, to have even an inclination that would bring you toward this is considered a great punya. Swamiji used it, I don't remember quite how he said this, but it was funny. He said, he was talking about this fellow, you know, who had a drinking problem. He was an alcoholic. He had a real drinking problem. So this fellow was able to find a bar anywhere.
Of course.
He could always find it, you know. Because
that's such a simple, brilliant statement.
I know.
Yeah, yeah, I've done that.
You know, there has to be some provision there. Call it a night?
Yeah. So we start 14 next week.
Yes. In fact, I'll have the handout for you.
Well, we're going into the final stretch.
We are.
I don't think left.
The only thing is
how many left?
Well, there's 18. But the thing is, you know, the chapters aren't long. Like chapter 14 is only going to take 3 or 4 weeks, 5 weeks maybe to do. 15 is not too long. There's a lot of material in that. But chapter 18 is like 100 verses.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It's really long. And chapter 18. 100
verses in chapter
18. I'll have to look and see. Yeah.
He doesn't want the movie to end. Right?
That's the whole conclusion. Let me just see exactly how many there are for you.
That's amazing.
Okay.
Big finale, huh?
Yeah.
Luxus and Lassie.
Yeah, 78 verses. Mm. In chapter 18.
Yeah. That's a year. Maybe
we'll get there.
But the other verses, other chapters have 20 verses, yeah. Not very many. But the chapter 18, just like chapter 2, it's the whole Gita. It's there in chapter 2. Chapter 18, also the whole Gita is there. It wraps it all up. Really,
but then
beautiful.
It's also there is under just 5 or 7 verses within chapter 2 that's so special.
No, it's like Flash Gordon.
In chapter 2?
Yeah.
No,
the
first 11 verses are still story.
Yeah.
And from then on, that chapter is really, really important, the whole chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the first 11 verses are almost part of chapter 1, telling the story. Yeah.
I'm reading the.